boss on his sedan. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I should say at first that I have been to Montreal before, and some of you I know have heard me before. Every time I go to Australia, there's a guy who stands up and says, "You said that 6 years ago in Melbourne." Bear with me if I say some things I've said before, because there are people here who won't have heard me say it, and I don't want to give you just what I've recently learned. However, I better start off with Gaza. I didn't go to Gaza because you couldn't report from there. The Israelis kept Western journalists out, but Palestinian journalists did a pretty good job. I was in a very dangerous country called Canada. I tell you why I find it so dangerous. It's because I read the papers here. Israel's friends were trying to explain to the people of Canada what it was like to be north of Gaza. For example, this is the Toronto Globe and Mail, of course. Maybe you have a home in South Vancouver, and militants living in Richmond are lobbing rockets every day across the Fraser River. Why should they be doing that? Already they destroyed the homes of a couple of your neighbors, taken out the food court at the Oak Ridge Center, leveled a nearby elementary school, damaged hundreds of tombstones at the Mountain View Cemetery, and flattened the Van Dusen Botanical Garden. Then I came to Toronto. I was writing politically about Gaza. Of course, I was watching it on television. And what do I find? Or, perhaps, you lived in Montreal's Outremont neighborhood. What have you got against the people of Outremont? And your children had weekly emergency drills because people who hated you, absolutely blindly hated you, and everyone from your community were launching missiles by the score from Outremont into your... There's something I don't know about Montreal. Into your cul-de-sac and the nearby playground, and they've been doing it for 7 years. When I got to Toronto as well, I found that it appeared that Mrs. Saga was firing missiles. Now, I wonder why Mrs. Saga was doing like that. And I arrived then in Montreal itself to find, I'll do the translation, this is La Presse. Imagine for a moment that the children of Lord Gilly were living... Is that something I don't know about Montreal? We're living day and night in chaos. Businesses, shops, hospitals, schools are the targets of local terrorists at Brossard. Will you enlighten me? What is this about Brossard and Longueuil? It's very odd, isn't it? I mean, there's something wrong here. But wait, I carried on to give a lecture in Dublin. And of course, I bought the Irish Times. Yes, you know what's coming, don't you? The questions, this is by an Israeli diplomat in a letter to the editor, "Dear Madam, the questions I've been asking the Irish people are fundamental to any discussion of Israel's action. What would you do if Dublin was subjected to a bombardment of, do I need to go on, 8,000 rockets and mortars similar to that endured by Israeli troops and cities for 8 years? Gone from 7 to 8. It took me one day to cross the Atlantic. This is incredible. And the stuff that was appearing in the newspaper, I mean, here is the editorial of the National Post, which I read, because sometimes I get the impression that the writers in the National Post want to deport all Canadians except for Anglo-Saxons back on ships to where they came from. But this is a risk. Israel's opponents have mastered such techniques as digging up graves and stealing bodies from mortuaries to inflate the carnage on the ground. They didn't need to inflate the carnage on the ground. And much of the Western media has reported casualty figures uncritically. You know, towards the end of the war, I was back in Beirut, and I was on the BBC World Service live for an hour. And I had an editor of the Jerusalem Post in Jerusalem talking with me. And he said, "You know, this is asymmetrical warfare. Numbers don't count. It's not about numbers." Of course not. More than 1,300 Palestinians and 13 dead Israelis. Two of the Israelis, by the way, were Israeli Arabs, although I noticed that did not reported. And I said, "You know what I said? If 1,300 Israelis have been killed, and thank God they have not, and only 13 Palestinians have been killed, you would not be making that argument on the BBC tonight." And there was a 3-second pause which spoke so eloquently. At the end of which the guy said, "We regret all deaths." And I said, "Good enough." Incredible. I mean, what are we journalists supposed to do? Are we really supposed to play war like it's a football match. You know, at journalism school, which we don't really have much of in England, I'm not a pro-journalism school person, though I rather offend a lot of people by saying that. Do history or economics or English. But nonetheless, at journalism school, when it's always taught, I was taught at my first local newspaper, the Newcastle Evening Chronicle, I was taught always that we have to give half our report to one side in a conflict or an argument and half to the other side. Now that's okay if you're reporting a football match, Manchester United versus Newcastle United. That's fine. And it's okay if you're reporting a public inquiry into a new motorway through a forest. You hear what the local government says, you hear what the people say, the protesters say. But the Middle East is not a football match. It is a bloody tragedy. And we must report it differently. I believe that we as journalists must be neutral and unbiased on the side of those who suffer. If we were reporting the slave trade in the 18th century, would we give equal space to the slave ship captain? Excuse me, no, we'd be talking to the slaves, the survivors. If we were reporting the liberation of a Nazi extermination camp, would you expect me to give equal time to the SS spokesman? Certainly not. When I was in Jerusalem in 2000, and I've said this before, I'm not sure, 2001, forgive me, in August, the clock was tick, tick, ticking. I was in St. George's Street when a suicide bomber, a Palestinian, set up a bomb inside an Israeli pizzeria, killing 16 Israelis, most of them children. I saw a woman with a chair left through her and a child with her eyes. Did I give equal time to Islamic Jihad? No, I did not. And when I was at Sabra Shatila in 1982, 1,700 dead, more than half the total of the World Trade Center. So I don't think Mr. Harper or any American president is going to go and pay his respects at the mass grave. Did I give equal time to the Israeli Defense Forces who sent the murderers in? No, I did not. I talked about the dead and the survivors. And I think it's time that journalists realized that we have to feel as human beings and have a certain morality. If you see an atrocity anywhere in the world, you're revolted by it. Well, we should be revolted by it too. What am I to make when I find the following letter in the National Post, 30th of December last year? Now that Israel has acted with an effective surgical maneuver, 1300 is quite a surgery, against Gaza's Hamas terrorists, terror infrastructure and smuggling tunnels, many are crying about a disproportionate response. They are incorrect. It is an insufficient response. Israel and the rest of the world have the right and the obligation to obliterate every single terrorist in the world. This is an ambitious undertaking, ladies and gentlemen. In Gaza, in Lebanon, Iraq, Afghanistan, and every country in the West, including those in Canada, who at this very moment are funding global terror activity. Can you believe this stuff is printed? It is an affront to the brave Canadian soldiers. Yeah, you're getting co-opted in here. It is an affront to the brave Canadian soldiers who are laying down their lives when anyone criticizes those trying to destroy the worldwide terror network. Seven terrorists in four paragraphs, that's not bad. Note here how Canadian soldiers are now roped in to the attack on Gaza. They are to be part of this new morality. What can we journalists do about this? I think Al Jazeera International may turn out to be a godsend for us. I know it wants to broadcast in Canada. I think it will. Tony Berman, who was a former boss in CBC, is now managing director. I'm actually going out to Qatar on March 14 to talk to the Al Jazeera people about what the international service might do to increase its coverage. It's very popular in Europe, by the way, an African nation. You just don't get it here, of course, or in the United States. But I think that might be one way out of the problem. But I do continue to feel deeply depressed when I read the press, Globe and Mail, National Post. I have to say, and I'm not saying this because I'm in Montreal, because I've said this before in articles, I find that the Francophone press is much better on the Middle East than the Anglophone press. This is why Anglophone press carry an infinitely more balanced account of events in the Middle East. I suspect, I didn't know why, but I suspect it's because they use the syndication service of the French press. If you have reports from Le Monde and Libération, you're going to have a pretty good idea what's going on. But if you're going to be the Globe and Mail and the National Post, and you're going to syndicate the works of the New York Times, my friend Tom Friedman, I gather his bill has gone up to almost 100,000 for a lecture now. I've said this before, I'll pay £100 not to listen to Tom Cruise. And not just the Top Times, but the Daily Telegraph, which is not going to give you a straight factual account, or even an emotional account, or a passionate account of what's going on in Gaza. He's not. He absolutely is not. So in a way, I think you live in the right city. Pity about the journalists, pity about the newspapers. You know, in 2006, in the war between Lebanon and the Hezbollah, I had a very instructive experience. Day after day, I would travel by car. Sometimes it feels like Hezbollah and Lebanon, no, Israel and Hezbollah. And I was going down almost every day to southern Lebanon with the air attacks on the roads around us, with a very prominent correspondent on a major American daily paper. I will protect his name, he's a friend of mine, and I will just tell you what happened. What was instructive was when we were on the way back at about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock, when of course it's morning in the East Coast of America, he started using his mobile phone. I should add, as I'm sure many of you know if you read what I write, that my editor prints what I write and doesn't change anything. And was caught by poor old friend at the back of the car, and the conversation would go like this. Hi, where'd the story go? Page one? Can you read the intro to me? I didn't write that! Where the fuck did that come from? What's a deadline? Is it Jerusalem or Beirut? And so it will go on, and so it will go on. Well, no, but you cut the sentence in half. Where does the second half of the sentence go? You see the problem. They were tampering with the story, making it safe. 50-50, but they're going to be okay. No complaints. And we know what the complaints are. Any journalist, and you've already heard, seen any journalist who dares honorably to criticize Israel will be called anti-Semitic, and it is a slander, a scandal, a libel. It's totally untrue. And the people who use that word, anti-Semitism, against decent people, are going to make anti-Semitism respectable, and shame upon them for it. I wish I could say that your latest visitor from Washington, who propped up the airways over Ottawa today, was going to change the Middle East. I don't think so. When he made his necessary visit to what I noticed the American press called the Holy Land before the American elections, he spent 45 minutes with the Palestinians and 24 hours with the Israelis. And I thought that pretty much told the story. Apparently, he didn't get on very well with Netanyahu, but that's not going to matter if Netanyahu becomes the Prime Minister. I don't think we're going to see any breakage in the absolute, total support, unconditional, for Israel by the United States. And I don't think Hillary Clinton is going to start arguing if she wants to be the next President of the United States, and that's not the way to do it. I was very struck when Time magazine made Barack Obama Person of the Year, we have to call it now, don't we? And in all this long interview, he devoted one sentence to the most critical, dangerous political crisis of our world, Israel and Palestine. I'd like to read it to you. Don't laugh. He's talking about the priorities of his next administration. And seeing if we can build on some of the progress, at least in conversation, that's been made around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict will be a priority. Don't lie. So what if this progress has been made? It is an absolute total catastrophe in the Middle East. I still believe that UN Security Council Resolution 242, withdrawal of Israeli forces from territories occupied in the 67 war in return for the security of all states in the area, including Israel, and of course the non-admissibility of acquiring territories through war, is the only basis for a real peace between Israelis and Palestinians. That is what Oslo was supposed to be based on. That's what the roadmap is supposed to be based on. But then again, we've got Tony Blair running the roadmap. My dear former Prime Minister. How this mendacious man can possibly, incredibly as it seems, think he's now the peace envoy for the Middle East. After having on his hands the blood of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, he's going to save Palestine. He's never even been to Gaza. You know, there was a very good article in the Sunday Times, because the puppy bore Rupert Murdoch owns the Sunday Times. I hate to say it, it was very good. And he was talking about this new faith that Blair had found. And she said, didn't God ever give him any advice? Back in February 2003, didn't God say to Tony Blair, Tony, this Iraq thing may not be such a good idea? But apparently that advice was not given by God. Presumably Tony gives advice to God, I don't know. I wouldn't want to take it, that's for sure. How can we have a situation where such a meretricious man can be a peace envoy and find faith? He's found God. Late, perhaps, but he's found it. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. But still, you know, I'm moving away from the subject, which is why don't we talk frankly about the Middle East? We're talking about Canada. Look, I was in Kandahar in December, a few weeks ago. I didn't go embedded with the Canadians or the Brits. I went on my own, and I went to the main hospital. There was a Taliban man dying of a bullet wound in the abdomen. There was a little girl who had acid splashed in her face by an Islamic anti-Greek fundamentalist, you call her what you like. But what was particularly striking is that through the day, parents arrived with dying children. They looked like sticks, skeletons. I said, what's wrong with them? They said, they're starving. He said, what? Did you know there was a famine in Afghanistan? No, what did I? And they kept coming in, they were putting two to each incubator. They didn't have enough incubators. Two to each one, and they were dying. I wrote at the end of my story that this time Obama was saying 7,000 more American troops for Afghanistan. I said, they need 7,000 doctors. You know, I'll tell you frankly what I feel now about the Middle East. I think we should leave. Military is tough. Military, we must get out of the Middle East. I've said this before. We always arrive in the Middle East offering democracy, human rights, freedom, and we always arrive with our Apache helicopters and our M1A1 Abrams tanks and our Bradley fighting vehicles and our guns and our troop carriers. And we always arrive saying we've come to liberate you. And we don't really pray. But when you ask people in the Middle East what they want, they ask for justice, which we do not intend to give them. And I think now that we've got so many soldiers in the Middle East. In the Muslim world, I calculated, we now have 22 times as many soldiers as the Crusaders had in the 12th century. Wow! You know, it was a Baghdad man who said to me, Mr. Robert, can you tell me why you are in Tajikistan, French air forces in Dushanbe, flying close air support to the British in Helmand province in Afghanistan? Why are you in Pakistan? Why are you in Afghanistan? Why are you in Jordan? Why are you in Turkey? Why are you in Egypt, where they now make the M1A1 Abrams tank? Why are you in Algeria? UN Special Forces are in special camp near Taman Rasset in the Southern Sahara. Why are you in Bahrain, headquarters of the US Gulf Fleet? Why are you in Qatar, largest US air base in the Middle East? Why are you in Kuwait? Why are you in Saudi Arabia? Why are you in Oman? Why are you in Yemen? Yes, why? We Germans don't ask this question. You've never seen this question in a single newspaper in Canada. But it's a good one. I have come to the conclusion myself, these countries don't belong to us. They are not our lands. And we should militarily leave. By all means, flood them with our doctors, our economists, our tourists, our visitors. But no more soldiers. Enough. It was very interesting that when I made a comment along these lines in Ottawa some months ago, there were several quite senior Canadian army officers in the audience, and they were the first to start applauding when they said that. Believe me, your soldiers whom I've talked to, they know very well what's going on in Afghanistan, and they do not think it's going to work, nor do I. The first contact I had with Canadians in any depth was in Bosnia, not when Mackenzie was in charge, but afterwards, where I spent a horrifying afternoon cowering in a trench with your soldiers while the Serbs tried to kill us. And there was a very fine young lieutenant, in the Canadian Army who was trying to persuade me not to be so cynical about the UN. Bang! Not so cynical. And he said, you know, Robert, if there'd been a UN before the First World War, there might not have been a Battle of the Somme. Now that was the kind of forward thinking, or maybe backward thinking, that soldiers should reflect upon. That's the job of your army. Peacekeeping, peacekeeping, peacekeeping. That is why you've been respected in the Middle East. But you're not going to earn respect in Afghanistan. Not like this. You know, I was giving a talk in Dublin not long ago, and my colleague, who was sort of co-hosting the thing together, Vincent Brown, he worked in Belfast when I was a correspondent there. He's a some Irish correspondent. He said, but surely, God, because I was, you know, doing the same old waffle I'm going to you tonight. He said, surely, God, the Muslims are a threat to us. And I said, oh, really, Vincent? You mean the Syrian army is in Dublin? You mean the Egyptians are on the streets of London? Or are the Jordanian army in Washington? Our soldiers are there. They are not here. And our soldiers should not be there because we do not own those countries. They do not belong to us. I'll anticipate a question on that later. Yes, I don't think the societies that will be produced in our absence will be societies we would like to live in, nor will they be the kind of democracy we would like to see. And I think, as I said before, Muslims, Arabs, they would like some of our human rights packages off our supermarket shelves and some of our democracy. But they must decide for themselves in the Muslim world what world they want to live in. We cannot do it for them. And I'm sorry if I'm stating the obvious when I say that that will not do a lot for gender equality in the Muslim world. There will be cruel punishments, but we cannot order that society. We cannot graft onto it what does not belong to us and what does not belong to them. You know, it's not so long ago that I found that John Hume, the only statesman in Ireland, had written an article to the Jerusalem Post in which he suggested that perhaps the Northern Ireland Good Friday Agreement could be of use to the parties in the Middle East. I love that word, the parties. The Americans always say, we can bring the parties together, but we cannot. It is up to the parties themselves to make the agreement. I don't know if the Israelis do what they want. But, you know, it's amazing. The Good Friday Agreement doesn't work in other places. You can't co-opt peace treaties from other places. The nearest, I said to John later, I said, John, the nearest parallel in the Middle East of the Palestinian-Israeli crisis is Ireland after the 17th century Catholic dispossession. And I don't think Oliver Cromwell wanted a peace mediator at the time. And we need to start seeing the Middle East as bad as it is. I want to give an example of how we can touch reality and do so in a very literary way without touching journalists. I'm going to read you, I have permission to do so, and I've read these two passages elsewhere in Canada, a couple of sections from letters home from a US Marine colonel in Fallujah. Actually, Ramadi is where he was based. He's writing home to his father, and I think he writes like Joseph Conrad. I've never read anything in journalism as good as this. He's trying to introduce local government to Ramadi and Fallujah for the Iraqis. We are trying to empower their own police to walk post instead of the Marines. There is something culturally childish in their understanding of basic Western governance and management that will require immeasurable education and probably several generations to overcome if they find it of any interest. That education is, of course, a choice they have to make on their own. They are not our people. Our understanding of their tribal governance and its relationship to formal civic management is equally naive and charges our frustration. The problem now is that their every inconvenience has become our responsibility. They act as if they cannot comprehend our sacrifices and are thus ungrateful for them. The reality is that they cannot culturally comprehend our altruism or believe our stated intentions. Even though it is not their desire to offend, we are insulted and it bleeds us of affection and tolerance. Liberation will compete with invasion as our legacy, but locally we are ideologically irrelevant. Our presence is mostly only of interest to those who seek to benefit from our contracts and donations. It is a region of people making alliances, business deals, friendships and enemies one day at a time without the real concept of sustainable services, resources, or trust. No future. Just daily survival, as they know, family and tribe. Our contributions may be counted long after we have withdrawn, but they will not recount the names of our fallen. So many now. Each wound will be absorbed into the quiet sadness that we allow to pass beneath us as a people in the country. Our loss will have never even occurred to most people here. Why don't I read this in the Global Mail or the National Post or the Daily Telegraph? This is the reality. This is the guy on the ground who knows what's going on. Now listen to this, he's trying to explain to his father that they've been holding elections. Stand by. So what news about the new government, you may ask? Well, the provisional military governor was replaced by the transitional governor, who resigned under threat and was replaced with another transitional governor. He was then replaced by the emergency-appointed governor, who was just replaced by the selected governor chosen by the elected provincial council. He never made a speech or publicised his views, never debated the other candidates, and was not present during the selection, never making an acceptance speech. He was promptly kidnapped by a rival tribe, while his tribe fought another tribe on the Syrian border. The recently displaced emergency-appointed governor returned in hopes of regaining the position. However, the deputy governor is now serving as the acting governor, while the actual selected governor is in captivity. But there was an election, so democracy is in full bloom, I am to understand. We are now trying to force, it's good to see you clapping an American soldier in Iraq. We are now trying to force the power of decision onto the elected provincial council and the city officials. It is a difficult thing to keep myself inactive in matters of governance here. The instinct to impose order and command the requisite discipline in the Iraqi leadership must be quelled in order to allow sovereign stewardship to develop at its native pace and in a native form. I fight myself to remain insignificant in the process. I haven't the nature for passive observation. I share the American fascination with action. And it has consistently betrayed us in our foreign policy. Our continued involvement will continue the state of dependency, and our eventual departure will leave nothing but cosmetic structure here. Iraq will return to what it is. Our common sense is not common to this people, and that understanding must be given proper respect. I do my best, but I twitch with an urge for the folly of intrusion. Now that is brilliant writing. Why don't we read that in our newspapers? Why don't our journalists grasp this? Why should it be a soldier who has to tell us these things? Because he's the only person who sees war? To take out Raymond's point, why haven't we seen any war? Why is it that only if an Iraqi is obliging enough to die romantically by the side of the road all in one piece, do we see a distant silhouette of his body? The price of war. But we don't see what I see. And if you saw what I saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, you would never ever support armed action anywhere in your life. Why don't we tell about history? Why don't we go back? I gave a Winston Churchill memorial lecture, if you can imagine such a thing. Churchill is not one of my great heroes. My PhD was in Irish neutrality in the Second World War, and Winston Churchill spent most of his time threatening to invade Ireland. But nonetheless, I'm drawn to find in my own researches for that period of 1920 in Iraq, from British files in London, a series of documents drawn up by the British Intelligence Service in 1920 by their agents in Baghdad. Here, for example, is a leading Baghdad divine, Alwan al-Yasri, the Yasri family is still in Iraq, talking to a British secret agent on the 5th of July, 1920. You have offered us independence. We never asked for it. We never dreamt of it, to put the idea into our heads. For hundreds of years, this country has lived in a state as far removed from independence as it is possible to conceive. Then you come with your promise of independence. And every time we ask for it, you imprison us. It happened in Egypt. We wanted democracy in Egypt, but we wanted it in Palestine, remember? Those pesky Palestinians voted for the wrong people. And in Egypt, we wanted democracy. And when the opposition spoke up and said they wanted to get rid of the king, we put them in prison too. Here is the Naqib of Baghdad, Abdul Rahman al-Naqib, talking to another British agent in 1919. What's all this talk of national self-determination, he wanted to know. He's talking here about President Wilson and his 14 points, the US president, who of course is president of the peace treaty of Versailles. What is all this talk of national self-determination, and what is its value? I trace it to America, and I hear the voice of Wilson. Does Sheikh Wilson know the East and its peoples? Does he know our ways of life and our habits of mind? You English have governed for 300 years in Asia, and your rule is an example for all men. Pursue your own way. Do not submit to guidance from Sheikh Wilson. That's the authentic voice of Iraq, isn't it? Even though it's almost 100 years, he got it right. He got it right. I won't take on Churchill himself now, because back in the 30s, when he was very poor, he put all his money in Wall Street shares, and the Depression arrived, here we go again. He was writing articles for the Daily Mail and the Daily Express to earn money. Here's an article I found I'll tell you how I got it actually. It's a 1936 copy of the Daily Express. I used to work for the Sunday Express in London. I was on the diary column chasing vicars who had run off with starlets. Not my most heroic hour, perhaps, but it was good practice for the Middle East. And one night I found that they were what's the phrase you use? François, you may remember when you used to photograph pages in the early days of Archive, of archives. Microfilm, that's right, microfilm. It didn't work, it was a catastrophe. But what they were doing was microfilming some of their millions of cuttings and throwing the rest out, back from water. So night after night, I went to the Daily Express library and stole every box of clippings of 1929 through to 1945. I've got a complete level of all newspapers, right through the Second World War, including everything Churchill wrote, even Churchill's official biographer, Martin Gilbert, didn't get this. Anyway, here is Churchill, writing from Morocco. He's been on holiday, French Morocco, of course, and he speaks glowingly of the excellent roads and boulevards and accommodation for the Western visitor. I will read you the last three paragraphs to show you that Churchill thought forward. The Arab inhabitants are a perpetual attraction with their flowing, many-coloured roads. Every peasant is a picture, every crowd a pageant. This is Churchill and travel, didn't know. If winter sunshine is the quest, here is its achievement. Thus far, all smiles. Is there a darker underside? The Arabs are a proud and ancient race, till only yesterday a race of conquerors. Are they tamed? Are they reconciled to this new civilization, with its order, its efficiency, its many benefits, its proofs of active progress and its sense of effort? Are they dreaming of the days of Arab greatness? The faith of Islam holds them all in a discipline of its own. From the balcony of an up-to-date hotel, I heard all night long the chants and drumbeats of the mosques, an endless repetition of choruses in which war and religion had an equal part. Who shall plumb the future? Ouch, as I always write on articles where I think someone's got it right. Back in 37, Churchill was 36, Churchill was spotting what was to come. Why don't we do that now? Is it because 24-hour television has sapped all the energy of our political leaders? Why is it that Churchill could talk such sense in opposition in 36? Well, when I listen today to the Browns and the Blairs, but even the Obamas, certainly the Harpers, if there's no relation to reality, why don't they plan? Why didn't you have plans for Afghanistan instead of just switching neatly from peacekeeping to war? Canada is now at war with Islamists in the Middle East. But one thing I've said repeatedly, and I'll say again, in the past we could go on these adventures abroad and get away scot-free. We'd have some bodies come home, it would cost money, treasure it, but we'd be safe. No North Korean ever blew himself up on the London tubes. No Viet Cong ever tried to blow up part of Washington, New York. The IRA had a go at London once or twice, but at the end of the day we talked to them. We talked to everybody. We still talk to the North Koreans at Panmunjom. We talk to the North Vietnamese in Paris. The IRA leadership has met the Queen. But the difference today is that we're not going to be safe at home anymore. The time when we had foreign adventures safe at home are gone. In Montreal, in London, wherever you may be, that protection has gone. And we need to realize it's gone forever. That is the price we need to think about if we stay in the Middle East. Do we want to pay that price? Is that what we want to do? Is that the world we're going to bequeath onwards? Look at the whole Iranian situation. We're desperately worried that the Iranians are going to acquire nuclear weapons. The story is, if you read the New York Times, mad mullahs and black turbans want to have an atom bomb to destroy Israel and America, who knows. The story of the Iranian nuclear facilities began long before that. It was the Shah of Iran who wanted nuclear facilities. And the Europeans stood on each other's shoulders to offer these facilities. Boucher, supposedly so dangerous, was built by Siemens, the German company. The Shah actually went to New York on his way to meet Carter at Washington, where Carter talks about the great love of the people there. And in New York, he did an interview with CBS in which he said, "I want an atom bomb." And when asked politely, of course, by the interviewer, why, he said, "Well, the goodness have got one. And the Soviet Union's got one. Why shouldn't Iran, our friend the Shah, the policeman of the Gulf?" I was in the room when Khomeini returned to Iran and said, in a room slightly smaller than this, "Nuclear facilities are the work of the devil and we shall close them down." And he did. It was only when Saddam began using gas components from the United States and Germany and continued to attack with his weapon of mass destruction and with our encouragement, the Iranian forces, that the Iranian military in 1984 went to Khomeini and said, "You better reopen the nuclear facilities. He's going to have an atom bomb next." Talking about Saddam. And so they did. Those are the nuclear facilities which are now being upgraded, supposedly, and may, perhaps, be producing a nuclear weapon. Now that's part of the story. You see, that earlier part of the story was snapped off and thrown away. We start off with the mad mullahs. Now I happen to think that Ahmadinejad is a crackpot. But I don't think Mohammed Khatami is, and I hope and pray he becomes the next president, because Obama could talk to him if he wants to. I'm not sure about nuclear weapons. Are we really going to go all our lives, generation after generation, saying, "Well, he's Pakistani, he's already got the bomb, so I suppose we'll only keep it. North Korea will leave them alone, they've got a bomb already." But Iran hasn't. Maybe we can attack them first. If I was someone living in the Middle East, I'd get an atom bomb bloody quickly. Seriously. But are we always going, for generations, to say, "Well, they can't have an atom bomb, they wear turbans"? You know, if it makes a country feel safer, they won't use it, that's fine. It is a deterrent. We use it. We have it. Even if two of our NATO nuclear submarines bumped into each other in the middle of the Atlantic the other day. That wasn't very clever, was it? How many million dollars is that going to cost to repair? I don't know. But no, seriously, the point I'm making is we need to rethink the whole issue of Iran, especially the scare stories. You know, senior members of the Pentagon went to Israel a few months ago to speak very, very toughly to the IDF leadership and to say, "Don't start a war with Iran, you're on your own. Because America does not have the military capacity to wage more than two wars. It's running out of steam. It doesn't have the manpower or the facilities or the weapons." If, of course, there is an attack on Iran, be sure the Iranians will shoot at American vessels in the Gulf, American forces in Iran. They will get one. These are the dangers we should be thinking of, looking out front of. Why don't we think of these things now? Why don't we plan for more than a month ahead? In 1941, when the Wehrmacht was still on the coast of France, before Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, Operation Barbarossa, we still waited for the Germans to land in England. Winston Churchill set up a cabinet committee in Downing Street to organize the post-war running of occupied Nazi Germany. 1941, 4 years before the end of the war. The next year, Cambridge University began a graduate course for civil servants to take over the running of the German government when the Nazis fell. 42, 3 years before the end of the war. We didn't have a plan for Iraq 4 minutes before we crossed the Tigris River. Something has gone wrong. We don't plan, we react to TV. Have we got Saddam Hussein? Can we put him on prime time? Well, can we hold that news for another hour? This is the way we live now. This is the way our politicians treat us. And this is why I think we are beginning to live in a kind of fraudulent democracy. I'm using the words of a US Marine officer to me at San Diego, a big Marine base, when I gave a lecture there some time ago. He said, "I elect my congressman," he goes to the House and he says the opposite of what I think. It's a major problem. I get more than half my letters come from the States. I get 250 a week and I don't use the internet or email. And the ones from Britain, the majority is saying the same thing. Our elected representatives no longer represent us. They don't listen to us. They will not respond. We demonstrate in the streets. You do too, of course. We petition them. We write letters to them. We plead with them. We go on television. It makes not the slightest difference. Now, I know, because I go to Washington, that governments don't work for democracy or human rights. What drives them is power. Power is what it was, political power in Washington. Don't wait for justice. Don't wait for democracy or human rights. They're there in a kind of facade way. They do exist there. It's about power, political power. And if you don't understand that, you won't understand whether there's absolutely no movement at all on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And there will not be. What do we do when we have Hamas, which, by the way, is a pretty claptrap organization. Let me take you down the road of serious thinking here. Hamas has killed more than 40 collaborators since the beginning of the war. In other words, they killed three times as many Palestinians as they did Israelis. And four of the Israelis who died shot each other in the state. Hamas is a forest of spies. Look how many of their leadership were managed to be killed by the Israelis in the war. Hamas thought they were Hezbollah. They're not. They thought Gaza was southern Lebanon. It's not. The Palestinians need to think a lot more seriously and politically before they embark on adventures. Now, I know that the Hamas ceasefire was actually broken by the Israelis. First on November 5th, when they killed some Hamas members, then on November 14th. It was not Hamas that broke the ceasefire, it was the Israelis. But they knew by ending the ceasefire, just as Hezbollah knew by capturing the Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon in 2006, that they would bring on an onslaught, and they did. I remember how Hezbollah said later, Nasrallah said later, if I had known the reaction, I would never have started the war. Well, excuse me, July the 12th, 2006 was my birthday. And I called my driver when I heard that they'd captured two Israeli soldiers and said, head south, the Israelis are going to bomb. Now, if Robert Fiskany's driver knew that, why would he pass on Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah? Excuse me. Nasrallah, who was the military commander in southern Lebanon, knows all about weapons and military tactics. He's a very smart guy. I know him. I've met him many times. No, I don't believe it. Interestingly, when I was lecturing in Chicago later in 2006, and I repeated this, a prominent imam from California berated me next morning when I was having breakfast with Hatami. Muhammad Hatami was in Chicago. He said, how could you be so rude about Nasrallah? And I said, listen, when it comes to theology, I listen to him. When it comes to military tactics, I'm sorry. I'm in the game of talking too. You know? And we need to be. We've got to be as critical as possible about those forces that claim to represent those who suffer. I'm sorry if that offends some of you, and it may well. But I'm not a great fan of Hamas. I never have been. I'm not a great fan of any of the various militias in the Middle East. I'll have to add, just to keep the playing field level, that I think that every army in the Middle East, including the Israelis, are a rabble. An indisciplined rabble. They don't care about human rights. They don't care about civilian violence. And don't make any mistake about it. You know, keep a level head when you get angry about the Middle East. I had to, you know, once in Dublin, I said, if anyone's mobile phone went off, they will be sold into slavery. And the phone immediately went off, and it was mine, so I have no objections at all. Let's go back to history again. How did Lawrence of Arabia get it right? Lawrence, who fought, of course, with the guerrilla army against the Turks in the 1914-18 war, and effectively helped the Arabs capture Damascus. Didn't do the king much good, but there we go. Here's what Lawrence was writing in 1929 in the Encyclopedia Britannica. His entry was under the word guerrilla. Exactly. He was writing, of course, of Arab resistance to Turkish occupation in the 1914-18 war. And he asks of the insurgents, some of whom he led, suppose they were an influence, a thing invulnerable, intangible, without front or back, drifting about like a gas. Armies are like plants, immobile as a whole, firm-rooted, nourished through long stems to the head. The Arabs might be a vapor. He was, of course, cashing in a little bit on the great horror of gas warfare in the First World War. Then he goes on, to control the land they occupied, the Turks would have needed 45 posts every 4 square miles, and a post could not be less than 20 men. The Turks would need 600,000 men to meet the combined ill will of the local Arab people. The Americans have got 300,000 and possibly 300,000 mercenaries, but that's only the same figure. The Turks had 100,000 men available. The 45 posts, of course, prefigured the famous surge. God, why do we use the militarist terms? There was a spike of violence and a surge of soldiers, didn't it? accurately predicting Al-Qaeda's modern-day use of the internet, Lawrence wrote that the printing press is the greatest weapon in the armory of the modern guerrilla commander. For insurgents, he wrote, battles were a mistake. Napoleon had spoken in angry reaction against the excessive finesse of the 18th century, when most men almost forgot that war gave license to murder. Tolstoy's War and Peace makes that very clear before Borodino. And Lawrence, realizing in his canny way that he was right, continued with these frightening predictions. Rebellion must have an unassailable base in the minds of men converted to its creed. It must have a sophisticated alien enemy in the form of a disciplined army of occupation. Too small to fulfill the doctrine of acreage, too few to adjust number to space in order to dominate the area effectively from fortified posts. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Afghanistan. The insurgency must have a friendly population, not actively friendly, but sympathetic to the point of not betraying rebel movements to the enemy. Rebellions can be made by 2% active in a striking force and 98% passively sympathetic. Granting mobility, security, time and doctrine, victory will rest with the insurgents. For the algebraical factors are in the end decisive, and against them perfections of means and spirit struggle quite in vain. If only could I send that to Obama. This is Afghanistan. This is Iraq. They got it right in 1920, 1929. Lawrence already understood, but we didn't get it. We didn't read this before we went to Iraq. We didn't read this before we went to Afghanistan. Why not? Why is history so useless these days? Is it because we're locked onto the internet and blogs? Is it because we simply scan our eyes down paragraphs and don't actually read? There was a very good article in the Atlantic Monthly a few weeks ago which suggested that the internet is blocking our way of perceiving words. It is allowing us to skim, to surf, not to actually read. And that deep reading, as the author said, is becoming very difficult for him. He's got used to just pressing that little button, not the delete button, which he should be pressing, but the button down. But deep reading, serious study of real literature and books and history is simply becoming impossible, or so difficult, it's not worth the time. I think this is a major problem. It's a problem as much as 24-hour television is. And I think that our leaders, Mr. Obama with his little BlackBerry, put the BlackBerry down. Read another book and think. You know, it's all very well for humble journalists to say all these things, but really, there is a major problem out here. There's a problem of journalism, there's a problem of politics, there's a problem of understanding. In the middle of it, we have the catastrophe of the Middle East, from the former British Indian Empire all the way to the Mediterranean. Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Gaza, the West Bank, Lebanon now. Will there be another war in Lebanon? I fear so. Not yet. I asked Saad Hariri, Rafiq's son, 5 days ago in Beirut, would there be another war? And he just looked at me and said, it would be hell. And he wasn't. He was in Jahannam. He meant it. I fear the next war in Lebanon, if it happens. I think the Hezbollah has the arm, as have the Israelis. Remember, one of the reasons for wars in the Middle East is to test weapons. Don't have any doubts about that. The Iranian military attaché in Beirut wants to see what the new missiles are like. The Americans want to see how their new bombs work on deep penetration explosions against the Hezbollah bunkers around Jazin, south of Jazin, near Lake Karaul. And if the Hezbollah can hit Israeli aircraft, then that means the Israelis no longer have air cover, which means we're into missiles. Remember the city war of missiles between Iran and Iraq, where they bombarded Baghdad and Iran? Are we going to have this on Beirut now? This, I think, is what Saad Hariri meant when he used the word hell. I'm very worried about it, because I live there. But we don't predict, we don't look forward, we don't even talk about it. It's like, oh, can the peace process go back on track? The clichés we've used are somnambulant, you know. And also, there's a wonderful French word, enfantinisme, which François probably agrees means babyishness. That's my best essence. It's the best translation. We're not even talking like children, we're talking like babies. And we don't understand the anger and the fury and the frustration that people feel. You know, not long after 2006, there was an incendiary atmosphere in Lebanon. I remember sitting on my balcony, where I've been sitting on for 30 years, and suddenly a stone pings off the wall. Someone had seen a white man on the balcony. Poor old Paul, you know, 30 years, still don't know what the bench. But no, seriously, you know, we need to think about why these things are happening and what we're going to do about it. And I don't have an answer for you. I don't know what to do. Look, one of the good things that came journalistically out of Gaza was that with the balancing Western journalists prevented from going there, Palestinians for the first time told their own story. Al Jazeera International, Al Jazeera Arabic, we had uncontaminated by the false balance of Western correspondents, we had a real story. And it's with considerable sadness that I tell you that our Palestinian correspondent in Gaza lost his father. I'm going to read you a small section of his report, which appeared on the front page of our paper, The Death and Life of My Father. This is what he wrote. The phone call came at around 4:20 p.m. on Saturday. A bomb had been dropped on the house at our small farm in northern Gaza. My father was walking from the gate to the farmhouse at the time. It was our beloved place, that farm and its two-story white house with a red roof. Nestled in a flat, fertile agricultural plain, northwest of Beit Lahia, it had lemon groves, orange and apricot trees, and we had recently acquired 60 dairy cows. It was the closest farm to the northern border with Israel. Ironically, we always thought the biggest danger there was not from Israeli troops, who usually went straight past if they were mounting an incursion, but from stray Hamas rockets aimed at the Israeli towns north of them. But shortly before sunset on Saturday, as Israeli ground troops and tanks invaded Gaza in the name of shutting down Hamas rocket sites, the peace of that place was shattered and my father's life extinguished at the age of 48. Warplanes and helicopters had swept in, bombing and firing to open up the space for the tanks and ground forces that would follow the darkness. It was one of those F-16 airstrikes that killed my father. The house was reduced to little more than powder, and of Dad, there was nothing much left either. Just a pile of flesh, my uncle, who found him in the rubble, said later, with brutal honesty. My grief carries no desire for revenge, which I know to be always vain. But in truth, as a grieving son, I am finding it harder to distinguish between what the Israelis call terrorists and the Israeli pilots and tank crews who are invading Gaza. What is the difference between the pilot who blew my father to pieces and the militant who fires a small rocket? I have no answers, but just as I am to become a father, my wife is pregnant, I have lost my father. I think that's the point where I'm going to end tonight. If you have questions and answers, I'm happy to take them. It just seems to me that in a way I'm preaching to you a message of despair, and I'm sorry that I see no hope in you. I haven't done it for a long time and I still don't. I used to think there was some hope in the number of young Lebanese people coming back to rebuild Beirut, but I have to tell you that many of the young people I know have left. They don't want to live in a sectarian world. They don't want to live in a confessional world. They don't want to live with a bomb over them. They've gone back to America, to Canada, to Geneva. So, all I'm going to... Yes, still young people are going back to Lebanon, but not enough. And I fear that's the story of the Middle East. It is bound up in ignorance, and secret policemen, and torture chambers, and lack of justice, no justice at all, and constant pressure from us Westerners. Constant. Military, economically, politically. And the danger has not passed. And Obama's arrival is not going to give us any hope in the Middle East at the moment. I think it's probably time for questions and answers. By the way, when we do finish that, I'll sign anyone who's got a book they want me to sign. Scott, do you want to come and see who wants to ask me a question?
Man in this. These books are $20, no tax, and we've got a lot of them, and I'm asking you for your own intellectual weight, and so we don't have to carry them back. Please buy as many as you can. Georgina and I are going to be passing out the microphones. If people want to ask questions, we'll pass the microphone to you.
Thank you.
have another mic up there somewhere, do we?
Thank you very much, Mr. Cook. As usual, it's a pleasure to have you here, Michelle. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit to us about what your feeling is about the upcoming elections in Lebanon. I suspect it's not very, it's a little bit cynical, but please go ahead.
I was discussing with Wahid Kamrat some weeks ago the elections in Lebanon, and he agreed with me that it needs three PhDs to understand the Lebanese political voting system. I think it probably needs four PhDs. Look, there's two things about it. I think there will be a centrist bloc which will prevent the opposition and the Hezbollah effectively winning the election. That's what you're asking. But the problem in Lebanon is it must become one day a modern state. And to be a modern state, it must abandon confessionalism. Well, you know, the president always has to be a Christian Maronite, the prime minister is Sunni Muslim, the head of parliament is Shia Muslim. But if Lebanon abandons confessionalism, it won't be Lebanon anymore, because sectarianism is the identity of Lebanon. And this is the problem. And the other problem is that all the leaderships of the various parties, on whichever list they stand, and if you don't understand the list system, I'm not going to explain it to you now, whatever they are, they will always sniff the air coming from Tehran or Washington or Paris or Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. I was launching the Arabic edition of my previous book in Nabatea in southern Lebanon. The audience were Hezbollah and Amal, mostly Amal, but quite a lot of Hezbollah. And one of the Hezbollah people said to me, "Mr. Robert, you are English, tell us what is the future of Lebanon." And I said, "You have no future as long as you ask foreigners like me what the future is. So don't ask Tel Aviv, don't ask Tehran, don't ask Damascus, don't ask Washington, don't ask Paris, don't ask London, and don't ask me." I said, "Go and talk to the people in Jibshit or Batroun, or go up the Ba'ar and talk to the people in Hamel. Then you'll find out what is the future of Lebanon." But unfortunately, the Lebanese won't do that, and that is their tragedy. And that's my answer to the question.
I have just a question about when you talked about Hamas or Hezbollah. Historically, I'm not a historian myself, but historically, each time there is an occupation and the occupier left, it's because somehow there is some fight to bring him out. So, do you believe that in the belief right now to get rid of this occupation, the Palestinians, let's say, if we talk about them, need some militias or some army or some. Because, it's hard to just say, okay, again, Hezbollah or again, Hamas, Israel left Lebanon, not because they just want to make peace, because they...
Look, Lebanon was freed of Israeli occupation because of the Hezbollah. There's no doubt about that. The resistance was Hamas. It's a fact. But Hamas has not driven the Israelis out. They have failed. So why did they start a war? Or why did they let the Israelis start a war? Or why did they give the Israelis an excuse to start a war? I was present some years ago when the Second Intifada was on, and I was in the Al Manar television studios, the Hezbollah television, doing a report on Al Manar. And I was sitting next to a Hezbollah fighter from southern Lebanon, whom I knew very well. I've been watching on the screen as all the Palestinians were, blah, 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 blah. They were at the funeral of a Palestinian martyr shooting into the air. So I turned to him, Hussein, and said, "Hussein, what do you think of this?" He said, "Robert," he said, "they waste all this ammunition. That's the problem with Hamas. It's not that I'm promoting any guerrilla movement. I'm not. I'm against all violence for any reason ever. But I think Hamas failed in any of its political intentions. It did not bring us any further forward. Hezbollah, I don't know. Hezbollah said they'd won a divine victory in 2006. It didn't feel very divine to me, although I think the Israelis lost. All I'm saying when I talk about Hamas and Hezbollah is not that I hate them a lot, and I don't do anything, I have to report them. But don't be starry-eyed about any of these various armed resistance movements. Don't. And that includes the Taliban, by the way, in a big way.
I'm concerned with one thing. Recently in the Middle East, which is a new story that's been severely underreported, is the process of acquiring nuclear weapons for Gulf countries such as the United Arab Emirates and other Gulf countries. And Israel already has this huge stockpile of nuclear weapons.
274 warheads, I believe.
That's all they say. You know it's more. But
274.
They declared it? Wonderful. Anyways, now that the United States is under a new administration, how much do you think that Obama will continue this? Because I know he said that he will try to curb nuclear proliferation, but I'm skeptical. Should I be?
Look, I don't think the United Arab Emirates are going to become a nuclear power. Nor is Saudi Arabia. I mean, they're going to need American technicians to show them how to do it, aren't they? I have to be frank with you, let's be grown up about this. The Americans are not going to have nuclear weapons built to the United Arab Emirates, absolutely not, not in any form. Maybe the Israelis will do it for them, I don't know at some point. This you never know, after all, the Israelis managed to supply the Iranians with missiles during the Iran-Iraq war. Remember that? Exactly. Look, I think this whole nuclear thing is a canard in the sense it's an attempt to take our eye off the most important issue. 2 years ago, here in Montreal, I said, forget about Iran, the problem is Pakistan. I said that here, in this room. And the papers came on out, and there was nothing about Pakistan. Just a little border problem, you know? And I kept saying, no, hold on a second, he's packed with Al-Qaeda. And he's got nuclear weapons. Now, suddenly, Richard Holbrooke goes to Pakistan first, and then goes to Afghanistan second. What I don't know is what Obama is going to do about Pakistan. That's a much more serious question than Afghanistan. Are we going to have American troops in Pakistan too? In the Swat Valley? I cannot believe it. There's got to be a point when we say, enough, we've got to go. Which comes back to my point earlier. We need a mic. Okay.
My question is about demographics in Israel-Palestine. Now, it's a hot topic nowadays. And studies show, studies done by Israeli government, I mean, we'll show that flip is bound to happen. Flip in the population number between the Israelis and the Palestinians. So by definition,
the surge for a moment.
So once that happens, and they say it's going to happen in the next 10, 15 years according to the studies, Israel is going to be, by definition, an apartheid state. Do you think this is the sole driver of what must be called Palestinian statehood nowadays?
Look, first of all, you need to reflect upon the words of Mr. Lieberman. I'm waiting to see if he's going to be a minister in the new government and how the West deals with him. Can you imagine if the Canadian government had a coalition which included a minister who said that minorities have to have loyalty tests? Or if the American government suggested that black minorities should have loyalty tests? I mean, we've got a government that waffles on about proof of Britishness, whatever that means. The British government should have to take the test as well, by the way. But the point I'm making is that, you know, it's a Lieberman factor we need to talk about and think about, not the question of the demographic scales. You know, there will be no right of return for the Palestinians, be sure of that. There will not be one state, there are going to be two states if there are two. What that Palestinian state will look like, I haven't any idea, but I don't think it's going to be the state that will work. Or the one that Mr. Blair keeps saying, it's got to be a viable state. What is a viable state? He wants to avoid the word just. You see, just if he's turning away, so viable is okay. This is a man who uses ceasefire as a policy option, rather than a humanitarian justice. Look, there's no doubt the Palestinian population growth is greater than the Israeli population growth. And that's one reason why the Israelis want more and more Jews from abroad to come to Israel. I can see why. I mean, it makes sense if you're looking at it from the Israeli point of view. I think Israel will probably continue as a state, though I'm not as sure of that now as I was, say, 30 years ago. No, that's what I'm saying. you're missing the point I'm making. It's that I'm not sure that Jewish communities abroad still have the same feelings towards Israel as they did earlier on. You know, things like Gaza are having an effect on liberal Jewish communities, especially in the United States. I mean, I go to the States almost every 3.5 weeks to give lectures, and more than half the people who invite me are Jewish Americans. Sometimes quite right-wing, but they do, and they're realizing that something has gone wrong, that something isn't working. Some months ago, I was in San Francisco about to give a this talk, and Jeffrey, who's Jewish, who was with me, we walked into this big auditorium in San Francisco, and like many beautiful new buildings in the United States, it's been erected with the help of a large number of philanthropists, many of whom, of course, are Jewish Americans. And we looked at all the names on the wall, and I said, Jeffrey, don't you sometimes feel that this is Israel? And that this country south of Lebanon is a small colonial project which may or may not work? And he said, yes, that's the way I'm beginning to think. I'm not saying that this is a key point that I've suddenly dug up, but I'm hearing this more and more. If you read Tikkun, you know, Rabbi Lerner's magazine, who asked me to write for a long time ago, I think you'll find that the message is there too. What is this Israel? What does it mean? Because it won't be the US government that will cut the umbilical cord. It will be a new movement among Jewish Americans. But again, the leading lobby groups remain. AIPAC is not a lobby group for Israel, of course. It's a lobby group for Likud. And we don't acknowledge that, unfortunately. I don't think the demographic issue matters at the moment. It will matter if Lieberman tries to put his policies into action. But I think there'll be a Palestinian state of some kind. It'll be so truncated, I don't think it'll work properly. It won't be just. It won't be founded on justice. It won't be in Jerusalem. And there's your problem. You can't have a Palestinian state with a capital called Abu Dis.
Stella Healy. Stella Healy from Citizens for Environmental Health. First, I would like to say thank you so much for your wonderful discourse. But secondly, I'd like to also mention that in carrying on this moment that you just mentioned, the media, the dawn of our democracy that I so clearly witnessed in the Globe and Mail, I asked if they would please explain why the Israeli ambassador had the privilege of being writing the editorial section for the Globe and Mail. But profoundly tonight, sir, I'd like to ask if you would share a little bit with us on the plight of the women and the children and how you foresee the recent occurrences and how we will, how their own destinies are addressed in the devastations that are facing our societies, especially in the Middle East. Thank you.
Yeah, well, first of all, I hate journalists who talk about things that they don't have enough first-person knowledge of. I have not been to Gaza since the war. I've been in Lebanon. I've been in Afghanistan again. I've been in Tajikistan. So I'm not the right person to ask on the present situation. I completely go back to the point I made earlier. If we go, that's the question you're going to have to ask. What will be the plight of women and female children? I don't know. I don't think, there's a big problem in my mind about the Muslim world. I'm making this deliberately provocative now. And that is how you align the Muslim world with the post-Renaissance Western world. I notice we always have books called Islam and the West, because there aren't many Christians left, you see. Maybe a few in the United States, but that's what we really say, Islam and Christendom. But I think there's a major issue here, which was brought up by a man I'm not terribly fond of, called Pope Benedict XVI. As you probably know, he was briefly and unwillingly, according to the Vatican, an anti-aircraft gunner in the Second World War on the German side. So I always refer to him in my paper as anti-gay, anti-divorce, and anti-aircraft. But when he made his statement at Regensburg, and you know the one I'm talking about, where he quoted a Byzantine leader on how Muhammad was an evil force, I don't think that was a mistake. This is the same man who went to Auschwitz, and to the outrage, justifiable outrage in my view, of Jews who were present, says it was the fault of a gang. I thought it was Nazi Germany that created Auschwitz, not just some small mafia clique in Berlin. And now I discover other things. Did you know he gave a secret audience contents undisclosed, to Oriana Fallaci, the Italian journalist, who died not long ago, who said that Muslims breed like rats. Did you know he deliberately pushed out of power, effectively, the former Secretary of State, Pope John, who was a pro-Palestinian prelate, who was very close to Michel Sabah, who is the Christian Orthodox Palestinian leader. There are clear signs there. And he also made a very strange comment at one point when he was asked about Israel. And he said to his Jewish questioner, if it's important to you, it must be important to us. And there's a very interesting, there's been a very good article, I'm going way off your point here, but we're coming back to it, in a recent issue of a race relations magazine in Britain, in which an American academic called Khoury, obviously Khoury originally, I assume he's Lebanese by origin, pointed out that in other remarks, the Pope had pointed out the Western nature of Christendom. He pointed out that there were some circumstances involving Christianity in the Middle East, like a Jew called Jesus and his disciples who got into trouble in the Middle East, right? But then, mercifully, one of those saints went off to Macedonia and the whole shebang became Westernized. So that was all right. There's something going loose there. But what I cannot find a way through to is how to differentiate the society that exists when I go to Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Iran or Afghanistan or Pakistan and the society we live in here, and presumably which we want to live in here. Was it because we had a Renaissance and maybe not? Or was it because there was an Arab Renaissance, but at a time when there might have been a deeper questioning of theological politics, of political theology? The enemy were at the gates. The West were pushing and pushing and pushing on the Islamic world. And so those freedoms, which we take for granted now, which admittedly in many cases only came in the last century, women's suffrage, for example, where some countries were in front of France, where they only got the vote after the Second World War, whether in fact there are real political, theological reasons for why women find themselves unequal in the Muslim world, which they do. And that is the issue I would prefer you thought about. The UN can always provide more biscuits and mattresses. We can always go in and build more houses until they get blown up again, and then we can build some more, and then they get blown up and we'll go and build some more. That's the story of Lebanon, as you know. But I think that for me, it's a much bigger picture. It's what this society, which we must leave alone, which we must not mess around with anymore, what will it be like? That is the question. That's looking forward. That's trying to do a Winston Churchill in the Middle East, if you like. That's the best answer I can give to your question.
Sean, let's look at it afterwards. We all know how Hamas and Hezbollah were created and why they were created. So I don't think they are the problem in the Middle East. Actually, we have to realize that the problem is a colonialist movement by Westerners, whites, that colonized Palestine. They happen to be Jews, but they colonized Palestine, and they are looking down upon the locals there who happen to be Arabs. It's a racist movement, and it's called Zionism. We are very afraid, and we are afraid of talking about that. So what I want to say, first of all, maybe a question. The question is, as long as we have a country like Israel, that all of prime ministers, presidents, foreign affairs,